torn down to make room for the inscriptions, and much of it trailed low in the dust and was withered already. Stepping in for a moment at the open gate and looking around me with the uncomfortable air of a stranger who had no business there, I saw the auctioneer's clerk walking on the casks and telling them off for the information of a catalogue compiler, pen in hand, who made a temporary desk of the wheeled chair I had so often pushed along to the tune of Old Clem. When I got back to my breakfast in the Boar's coffee room, I found Mr. Pumblechook conversing with the landlord. Mr. Pumblechook, not improved in appearance by his late nocturnal adventure, was waiting for me and addressed me in the following terms.
"Young man, I am sorry to see you brought low, but what else could be expected? What else could be expected?"
He extended his hand with a magnificently forgiving air, and as I was broken by illness and unfit to quarrel, I took it.
"William," said Mr. Pumblechook to the waiter, "put a muffin on table. And has it come to this? Has it come to this?"
I frowningly sat down to my breakfast. Mr. Pumblechook stood over me and poured out my tea before I could touch the teapot, with the air of a benefactor who was resolved to be true to the last.
"William," said Mr. Pumblechook mournfully, "put the salt on. In happier times," addressing me, "I think you took sugar. And did you take milk? You did. Sugar and milk, William. Bring a watercress."
"Thank you," said I shortly, "but I don't eat watercresses."
"You don't eat them,"
returned Mr. Pumblechook, sighing and nodding his head several times, as if he might have expected that, and as if abstinence from watercresses was consistent with my downfall.
"True. The simple fruits of the earth. No, you needn't bring any, William."
I went on with my breakfast, and Mr. Pumblechook continued to stand over me, staring fishily and breathing noisily, as he always did.
"Little more than skin and bone," mused Mr. Pumblechook aloud. "And yet when he went away from here, I may say with my blessing, and I spread afore him my humble store like the bee, he was as plump as a peach."
This reminded me of the wonderful difference between the servile manner in which he had offered his hand in my new prosperity, saying, "May I?" and the ostentatious clemency with which he had just now exhibited the same fat five fingers.
"Ah," he went on, handing me the bread and butter, "and are you going to Joseph?"
"In heaven's name," said I, firing in spite of myself, "what does it matter to you where I am going? Leave that teapot alone." It was the worst course I could have taken, because it gave Pumblechook the opportunity he wanted.
"Yes, young man,"
said he, releasing the handle of the article in question, retiring a step or two from my table, and speaking for the behoof of the landlord and waiter at the door.
"I will leave that teapot alone. You are right, young man. For once, you are right. I forget myself when I take such an interest in your breakfast as to wish your frame, exhausted by the debilitating effects of prodigiality, to be stimulated by the wholesome nourishment of your forefathers. And yet," said Pumblechook, turning to the landlord and waiter, and pointing me out at arm's length, "this is him as I ever sported with in his days of happy infancy. Tell me not it cannot be. I tell you, this is him."
A low murmur from the two replied. The waiter appeared to be particularly affected.
"This is him," said Pumblechook, "as I have rode in my shay-cart. This is him as I have seen brought up by hand. This is him unto the sister of which I was uncle by marriage, as her name was Georgiana Maria from her own mother. Let him deny it if he can."
The waiter seemed convinced that I could not deny it, and that it gave the case a black look.
"Young man," said Pumblechook, screwing his head at me in the old fashion, "you are a-going to Joseph. What does it matter to me, you ask me, where you are a-going? I say to you, sir, you are a-going to Joseph."
The waiter coughed, as if he modestly invited me to get over that.
"Thou,"
said Pumblechook, and all this with a most exasperating air of saying in the cause of virtue what was perfectly convincing and conclusive.
I will tell you what to say to Joseph. Here are squires of the boar present, known and respected in this town. And here is William, which his father's name was Potkins, if I do not deceive myself.
You do not, sir, said William.
In their presence, pursued Pumblechook, I will tell you, young man, what to say to Joseph. Says you, Joseph, I have this day seen my earliest benefactor and the founder of my fortunes. I will name no names, Joseph, but so they are pleased to call him uptown, and I have seen that man.
I swear I don't see him here, said I.
Say that likewise, retorted Pumblechook. Say you said that, and even Joseph will probably betray surprise.
There you quite mistake him, said I. I know better.
Says you, Pumblechook went on, Joseph, I have seen that man, and that man bears you no malice, and bears me no malice. He knows your character, Joseph, and is well acquainted with your pig-headedness and ignorance. And he knows my character, Joseph, and he knows my want of gratitude. Yes, Joseph, says you.
Here Pumblechook shook his head and handed me.
He knows my total deficiency of common human gratitude. He knows it, Joseph, as none can. You do not know it, Joseph, having no call to know it, but that man do.
Windy donkey as he was, it really amazed me that he could have the face to talk thus to mine.
Says you, Joseph, he gave me a little message, which I will now repeat. It was that in my being brought low, he saw the finger of Providence. He knowed that finger when he saw it, Joseph, and he saw it plain. It pointed out this writing, Joseph. Reward of ingratitude to earliest benefactor and founder of fortunes. But that man said that he did not repent of what he had done, Joseph. Not at all. It was right to do it. It was kind to do it. It was benevolent to do it. And he would do it again.
It's a pity, said I scornfully, as I finished my interrupted breakfast, that the man did not say what he had done and would do again.
Squires of the Boar, Pumblechook was now addressing the landlord, and William, I have no objections to your mentioning either uptown or downtown, if such should be your wishes, that it was right to do it, kind to do it, benevolent to do it, and that I would do it again.
With those words, the impostor shook them both by the hand with an air and left the house, leaving me much more astonished than delighted by the virtues of that same indefinite it. I was not long after him in leaving the house too, and when I went down the high street I saw him holding forth, no doubt to the same effect, at his shop door to a select group, who honoured me with very unfavourable glances as I passed on the opposite side of the way. But it was only the pleasanter to turn to Biddy and to Joe, whose great forbearance shone more brightly than before, if that could be, contrasted with this brazen pretender. I went towards them slowly, for my limbs were weak, but with a sense of increasing relief as I drew nearer to them, and a sense of leaving arrogance and untruthfulness further and further behind. The June weather was delicious. The sky was blue, the larks were soaring high over the green corn. I thought all that countryside more beautiful and peaceful by far than I had ever known it to be yet. Many pleasant pictures of the life that I would lead there, and of the change for the better that would come over my character when I had a guiding spirit at my side, whose simple faith and clear home wisdom I had proved, beguiled my way. They awakened a tender emotion in me, for my heart was softened by my return, and such a change had come to pass that I felt like one who was toiling home barefoot from distant travel, and whose wanderings had lasted many years. The schoolhouse, where Biddy was mistress, I had never seen, but the little roundabout lane by which I entered the village, for quietness's sake, took me past it. I was disappointed to find that the day was a holiday, no children were there, and Biddy's house was closed. Some hopeful notion of seeing her busily engaged in her daily duties before she saw me had been in my mind and was defeated. But the forge was a very short distance off, and I went towards it under the sweet green limes, listening for the clink of Joe's hammer. long after I ought to have heard it, and long after I had fancied I heard it and found it but a fancy, all was still. The limes were there, and the white thorns were there, and the chestnut trees were there, and their leaves rustled harmoniously when I stopped to listen. But the clink of Joe's hammer was not in the midsummer wind. Almost fearing, without knowing why, to come in view of the forge, I saw it at last, and saw it was closed. No gleam of fire, no glittering shower of sparks, no roar of bellows. All shut up and still. But the house was not deserted, and the best parlour seemed to be in use, for there were white curtains fluttering in its window, and the window was open and gay with flowers. I went softly towards it, meaning to peep over the flowers, when Joe and Biddy stood before me, arm in arm. At first Biddy gave a cry, as if she thought it was my apparition, but in another moment she was in my embrace. I wept to see her, and she wept to see me. I, because she looked so fresh and pleasant. She, because I looked so worn and white. "But, dear Biddy, how smart you are!"
"Yes, dear Pip."
"And Joe, how smart you are!"
"Yes, dear old Pip, old chap."
I looked at both of them, from one to the other, and then,
"It's my wedding day,"
cried Biddy in a burst of happiness,
"and I am married to Joe."
They had taken me into the kitchen, and I had laid my head down on the old deal table. Biddy held one of my hands to her lips, and Joe's restoring touch was on my shoulder.
"Which he warn't strong enough, my dear, fair to be surprised," said Joe.
And Biddy said,
"I ought to have thought of it, dear Joe, but I was too happy."
They were both so overjoyed to see me, so proud to see me, so touched by my coming to them, so delighted that I should have come by accident to make their day complete. My first thought was one of great thankfulness that I had never breathed this last baffled hope to Joe. How often, while he was with me in my illness, had it risen to my lips? How irrevocable would have been his knowledge of it, if he had remained with me but another hour.
"Dear Biddy,"
said I, "you have the best husband in the whole world, and if you could have seen him by my bed, you would have... But no, you couldn't love him better than you do."
"No, I couldn't indeed," said Biddy.
"And dear Joe, you have the best wife in the whole world, and she will make you as happy as even you deserve to be, you dear, good, noble Joe." Joe looked at me with a quivering lip and fairly put his sleeve before his eyes. "And Joe and Biddy both, as you have been to church today and are in charity and love with all mankind, receive my humble thanks for all you have done for me and all I have so ill repaid. And when I say that I am going away within the hour, for I am soon going abroad, and that I shall never rest until I have worked for the money with which you have kept me out of prison, and have sent it to you. Don't think, dear Joe and Biddy, that if I could repay it 1,000 times over, I suppose I could cancel a farthing of the debt I owe you, or that I would do so if I could." They were both melted by these words, and both entreated me to say no more. "But I must say more, dear Joe. I hope you will have children to love, and that some little fellow will sit in this chimney corner of a winter night who may remind you of another little fellow gone out of it for ever. Don't tell him, Joe, that I was thankless. Don't tell him, Biddy, that I was ungenerous and unjust. Only tell him that I honoured you both because you were both so good and true, and that as your child I said it would be natural to him to grow up a much better man than I did."
"I ain't a-goin'," said Joe from behind his sleeve, "to tell him nothing of that nature, Pip. Nor Biddy ain't, nor yet no one ain't.
And now, though I know you have already done it in your own kind hearts, pray tell me, both, that you forgive me. Pray let me hear you say the words, that I may carry the sound of them away with me, and then I shall be able to believe that you can trust me, and think better of me in the time to come."
"Oh, dear old Pep, old chap," said Joe,
"God knows as I forgive you, if I have anything to forgive."
"Amen, and God knows I do,"
echoed Biddy.
And now let me go up and look at my old little room, and rest there a few minutes by myself. And then, when I have eaten and drunk with you, go with me as far as the finger-post, dear Joe and Biddy, before we say good-bye. I sold all I had, and put aside as much as I could for a composition with my creditors, who gave me ample time to pay them in full, and I went out and joined Herbert. Within a month I had quitted England, and within 2 months I was clerk to Clariker and Co., and within 4 months I assumed my first undivided responsibility, for the beam across the parlour ceiling at Mill Pond Bank had then ceased to tremble under old Bill Barley's growls and was at peace, and Herbert had gone away to marry Clara, and I was left in sole charge of the Eastern Branch until he brought her back. Many a year went round before I was partner in the house, but I lived happily with Herbert and his wife, and lived frugally, and paid my debts, and maintained a constant correspondence with Biddy and Joe. It was not until I became third in the firm that Clariker betrayed me to Herbert, but he then declared that the secret of Herbert's partnership had been long enough upon his conscience, and he must tell it. So he told it, and Herbert was as much moved as amazed, and the dear fellow and I were not the worse friends for the long concealment. I must not leave it to be supposed that we were ever a great house, or that we made mints of money. We were not in a grand way of business, but we had a good name, and worked for our profits, and did very well. We owed so much to Herbert's ever-cheerful industry and readiness that I often wondered how I had conceived that old idea of his inaptitude, until I was one day enlightened by the reflection that perhaps the inaptitude had never been in him at all, but had been in me.
Chapter 59. For 11 years I had not seen Joe nor Biddy with my bodily eyes, though they had both been often before my fancy in the East, when upon an evening in December, an hour or two after dark, I laid my hand softly on the latch of the old kitchen door. I touched it so softly that I was not heard, and I looked in unseen. There, smoking his pipe in the old place by the kitchen firelight, as hale and as strong as ever, though a little grey, sat Joe. And there, fenced into the corner with Joe's leg, and sitting on my own little stool, looking at the fire, was I again.
"We gave him the name of Pep, for your sake, dear old chap," said Joe, delighted, when I took another stool by the child's side,
but I did not rumple his hair.
"We hoped he might grow a little bit like you, and we think he do."
I thought so too, and I took him out for a walk next morning, and we talked immensely, understanding one another to perfection. And I took him down to the churchyard, and set him on a certain tombstone there, and he showed me from that elevation which stone was sacred to the memory of Philip Pirrip, late of this parish, and also Georgiana, wife of the above.
"Biddy," said I, when I talked with her after dinner, as her little girl lay sleeping in her lap,
"you must give Pip to me one of these days, or lend him at all events."
"No, no," said Biddy gently. "You must marry."
"So Herbert and Clara say, but I don't think I shall, Biddy. I have so settled down in their home that it's not at all likely. I'm already quite an old bachelor."
Biddy looked down at her child, and put its little hand to her lips, and then put the good matronly hand with which she had touched it into mine. There was something in the action, and in the light pressure of Biddy's wedding ring, that had a very pretty eloquence in it.
"Dear Pip," said Biddy, "are you sure you don't fret for her?"
"Oh, no, I think not, Biddy."
"Tell me, as an old, old friend, have you quite forgotten her?"
"My dear Biddy, I have forgotten nothing in my life that ever had a foremost place there, and little that ever had any place there. But that poor dream, as I once used to call it, has all gone by, Biddy.
all gone by. Nevertheless, I knew while I said those words that I secretly intended to revisit the site of the old house that evening, alone, for her sake. Yes, even so, for Estella's sake. I had heard of her as leading a most unhappy life, and as being separated from her husband, who had used her with great cruelty, and who had become quite renowned as a compound of pride, avarice, brutality, and meanness. And I had heard of the death of her husband, from an accident consequent on his ill-treatment of a horse. This release had befallen her some 2 years before. For anything I knew, she was married again. The early dinner hour at Joe's left me abundance of time, without hurrying my talk with Biddy, to walk over to the old spot before dark. But what with loitering on the way to look at old objects and to think of old times, the day had quite declined when I came to the place. There was no house now, no brewery, no building whatever left, but the wall of the old garden. The cleared space had been enclosed with a rough fence, and looking over it, I saw that some of the old ivy had struck root anew and was growing green on low, quiet mounds of ruin. A gate in the fence, standing ajar, I pushed it open and went in. A cold, silvery mist had veiled the afternoon, and the moon was not yet up to scatter it. But the stars were shining beyond the mist, and the moon was coming, and the evening was not dark. I could trace out where every part of the old house had been, and where the brewery had been, and where the gates, and where the casks. I had done so, and was looking along the desolate garden walk, when I beheld a solitary figure in it. The figure showed itself aware of me as I advanced. It had been moving towards me, but it stood still. As I drew nearer, I saw it to be the figure of a woman. As I drew nearer yet, it was about to turn away, when it stopped, and let me come up with it. Then it faltered, as if much surprised, and uttered my name. And I cried out, "Estella!"
"I am greatly changed. I wonder you know me."
The freshness of her beauty was indeed gone, but its indescribable majesty and its indescribable charm remained. Those attractions in it I had seen before. What I had never seen before was the saddened, softened light of the once proud eyes. What I had never felt before was the friendly touch of the once insensible hand. We sat down on a bench that was near, and I said, "After so many years, it is strange that we should thus meet again, Estella, here, where our first meeting was. Do you often come back?"
"I have never been here since."
"Nor I." The moon began to rise, and I thought of the placid look of the white ceiling which had passed away. The moon began to rise, and I thought of the pressure on my hand when I had spoken the last words he had heard on earth. Estella was the next to break the silence that ensued between us.
"I have very often hoped and intended to come back, but have been prevented by many circumstances. Poor, poor old place."
The silvery mist was touched with the first rays of the moonlight, and the same rays touched the tears that dropped from her eyes. Not knowing that I saw them, and setting herself to get the better of them, she said quietly,
"Were you wondering, as you walked along, how it came to be left in this condition?"
"Yes, Estella."
"The ground belongs to me. It is the only possession I have not relinquished. Everything else has gone from me, little by little. But I have kept this. It was the subject of the only determined resistance I made in all the wretched years."
"Is it to be built on?"
"At last it is. I came here to take leave of it before its change. And you," she said in a voice of touching interest to a wanderer, "you live abroad still?"
"Still."
"And do well, I am sure."
I work pretty hard for a sufficient living, and therefore, yes, I do well.
I have often thought of you, said Estella.
Have you?
Of late, very often. There was a long, hard time when I kept far from me the remembrance of what I had thrown away when I was quite ignorant of its worth. But since my duty has not been incompatible with the admission of that remembrance, I have given it a place in my heart.
You have always held your place in my heart, I answered, and we were silent again until she spoke.
I little thought, said Estella, that I should take leave of you in taking leave of this spot. I am very glad to do so.
Glad to part again, Estella. To me, parting is a painful thing. To me, the remembrance of our last parting has been ever mournful and painful.
But you said to me, returned Estella very earnestly, God bless you, God forgive you. And if you could say that to me then, you will not hesitate to say that to me now. Now, when suffering has been stronger than all other teaching, and has taught me to understand what your heart used to be. I have been bent and broken, but, I hope, into a better shape. Be as considerate and good to me as you were, and tell me we are friends.
We are friends, said I, rising and bending over her, as she rose from the bench.
And we'll continue friends apart, said Estella.
I took her hand in mine, and we went out of the ruined place, and as the morning mists had risen long ago, when I first left the forge, so the evening mists were rising now, and in all the broad expanse of tranquil light they showed to me, I saw no shadow of another parting from her. The original ending to Great Expectations. In the third volume of his biography of Dickens, published 13 years after Great Expectations, John Forster revealed that the novel's ending, as it had appeared in print, was in fact not its original one. The author had been persuaded by his friend Edward Bulwer Lytton, a novelist and critic, to alter the final scene while the text was still in proofs, granting Pip a slightly happier, though certainly still ambiguous, reunion with Estella. Dickens wrote to Forster in July 1861, "You will be surprised to hear that I have changed the end of Great Expectations from and after Pip's return to Joe's, and finding his little likeness there, Bulwer, who has been, as I think you know, extraordinarily taken by the book, so strongly urged it upon me, after reading the proofs, and supported his view with such good reasons, that I resolved to make the change. I have put in as pretty a little piece of writing as I could, and I have no doubt the story will be more acceptable through the alteration." Forster supplied Dickens' original ending in a footnote, explaining by way of preface that what we know as the final chapter break in Great Expectations was absent. The paragraph describing Herbert's business led directly to that regarding the last time Pip had seen Joe, and that the 8 years since Pip and Joe had met were shortened from 11 years in the first version. Inadvertently, Forster created confusion by reversing those numbers. It is the published text that reads 11 years. The original ending was printed in Forster's note as a single paragraph, but as Edgar Rosenberg points out in his article, Last Words on Great Expectations, it appears as 4 paragraphs in the proofs, a more reliable indicator of Dickens' intent before he changed the text altogether. Pip's line, "Oh no, I think not, Biddy," initially read, "I am sure and certain, Biddy," and the scene continued as follows. It was 2 years more before I saw herself. I had heard of her as leading a most unhappy life, and as being separated from her husband, who had used her with great cruelty, and who had become renowned as a compound of pride, brutality, and meanness. I had heard of the death of her husband, from an accident consequent on ill-treating a horse, and of her being married again to a Shropshire doctor, who against his interest had once very manfully interposed on an occasion when he was in professional attendance on Mr. Drummle, and had witnessed some outrageous treatment of her. I had heard that the Shropshire doctor was not rich, and that they lived on her own personal fortune. I was in England again, in London, and walking along Piccadilly with little Pip, when a servant came running after me to ask would I step back to a lady in a carriage who wished to speak to me. It was a little pony carriage which the lady was driving, and the lady and I looked sadly enough on one another.
"I am greatly changed, I know, but I thought you would like to shake hands with Estella too, Pip. Lift up that pretty child, and let me kiss it."
She supposed the child, I think, to be my child. I was very glad afterwards to have had the interview, for in her face and in her voice and in her touch, she gave me the assurance that suffering had been stronger than Miss Havisham's teaching, and had given her a heart to understand what my heart used to be.
This concludes the reading of Great Expectations by Charles Dickens, originally published in 1861. This book was read by Simon Preble. This unabridged recording was produced in 2011 by Blackstone Audio, Inc., which holds the copyright. Neither this recording nor any portion of it may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authorization from Blackstone Audio, Inc. If you would like to obtain a monthly update telling you about new releases, call 1-800-SAY-BOOK. That's 1-800-729-2665. For a complete listing of our titles, visit our website at www.blackstoneaudio.com. Thank you.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.